Come right in, pull up a chair, and join your friends at the Gaming Gang. This time around, Jeff flies solo and takes a look at 10 Days in the Americas from Out of the Box Publishing. 1955, The War of Espionage, a game looking to be produced by Living Worlds Games, financed through Kickstarter pledges. Maneuver and Labyrinth, The War on Terror, both by GMT Games. And a healthy dose of gaming news. All that and more on this edition of The Gaming Gang. Now here's your host, well, me. Hi again, it's Jeff McAleer, and I'm taking the helm all by my lonesome for this episode. My co-host, Elliot Miller, and I have had a difficult time getting on the same page to record the show. So, rather than continue to push the program back, I've decided to sally forth alone. The show might be a bit shorter than usual, but it is going to be packed with gaming goodness, I promise. I'm recording this on the day after Christmas, and I'd like to take a moment on behalf of Elliot, James, and myself to make sure that everyone out there had a most joyous holiday. Sorry if I'm not the most politically correct person out there, so if anyone listening happens to celebrate any other winter holiday, we surely wish those to have been wonderful as well. And in case we don't have a chance for you to touch base with us before the calendar turns, I'll include a hearty Happy New Year just for good measure. Here at the Gaming Gang, we feel that the most important aspect of gaming is the friendship and community afforded us through our great hobby. We look at everyone we come in contact with, be they gamers or the people who make these great games we talk about and write about, as prospective good friends. I believe this is something that's noticed when you stop by our website or listen to this show. My sincerest hope is everything that we do reflects positively on the industry and the people within it. Now, I've never claimed that we boys at the Gaming Gang are professionals, and we're hard at work to add some girls. No one is a professional writer, web designer, reviewer, search engine optimizer, radio personality, business entrepreneur, or any such thing. I personally think James is a fantastic writer. Elliot really is obviously as nice a person as he comes across on the podcast. Little kids and animals love me. Little kids, animals, that should be worth something, right? Yet, all of you took a gamble with us, either listening to the show or visiting the site, knowing that we were new to the whole gaming website thing. A lot of gamers have asked, why would anyone launch a game site when you have XYZ or ABC out there? I still get emails or see posts on forums asking me that very question. I suppose it's an interesting query for some, but you might as well ask why someone would look to make a movie, paint a picture, write a book, record a song. Better yet, why invent a game? Aren't all the greats already right here for us to enjoy? It's all been done before, hasn't it? I love Casablanca. I mean, I love that movie. And I'm amazed by Citizen Kane. Yet that never had stopped me from seeing Schindler's List, Driving Miss Daisy, or even Inception. Having read just about everything by Mark Twain didn't curtail my reading of, say, Stephen King. By now, I'm certain my point is pretty obvious. We have a lot of big things planned for the Gaming Gang in the new year. So I do ask all of you to stay tuned. So without any further ado, let's get down to business. But before I do so, once again, this episode of The Gaming Gang is sponsored by Victory Point Games and their latest release, Astra Titanis. At the end of the Exodus Wars, the first interstellar battle between four star empires, a gigantic alien war machine devastated the frontier worlds. The war-weary militaries of all four empires joined together as one and sent massive fleets of capital ships and escorts to the beleaguered frontier worlds at faster-than-light speeds. Astra Titanis is a solitaire game of space opera battles featuring fleets of highly advanced military starships that are dwarfed by a single alien robotic ship, a Star Titan. The Titan is controlled by cards that determine movement, special weapon use, and targeting priorities. The human ships jump across space using faster-than-light drives. There are energy beams that shatter small moons and missiles that accelerate to a substantial fraction of C, the speed of light. As Admiral, you must send your sailors out into the void against the overwhelming might of the Astra Titanis. This latest release from the creative mind of Chris Taylor promises to be yet another sleeper hit for Victory Point Games, where the game plays the thing. And while you're visiting victorypointgames.com, be sure to check out their latest special, the White Star 6-Pack. This special deal should really appeal to the wargamers out there, because you'll be able to score six great World War II Western Front war games, all for one low price. On to the news. I did just mention the show's sponsor, VPG, and they have an open playtest coming up on Tuesday, December 28th at their Orange County, California location. Designer Luke Hughes will be at the VPG offices from 10 a.m. through the afternoon, showing off his new game, The World Will Hold Its Breath, another VPG monster World War II game telling the huge story of the European Theater of Operations in a solitaire setting where the player commands the Axis forces. You must make key military, economic, and political decisions for every phase of the war, from Blitzkrieg to the bunker, as the game's two paper opponents come at you from the west and the east. With a panoramic grand strategic view of events, you'll quickly see the causes and consequences of every decision on every front and through every campaign. Also, anyone attending the open house on the 28th will receive 20% off any non-sale items, so you not only get the chance to check out the latest design on the horizon, but save some serious dough on some great games. Mayfair Games announced this week that they'll be reprinting the Avalon Hill Classic 1830. Covering the years 1830, obviously, to the present, players become the stockholders of America's first railroad corporations. Since the largest shareholder becomes president, players compete for control of the strongest firms. Presidents generate revenue by building track and buying and operating trains, regardless of the shareholders' needs. Pay heed to the volatile stock market and strive to invest in flourishing companies in order to earn healthy dividends. Players will try to buy stock in corporations that are rising in value, collect strong, and sell before the stock values drop. 1830 contains, in addition to the original rules and components, a faster-playing basic game and a host of exciting new variants from some of the world's best railroad game designers. 1830 is suitable for 3-6 players ages 12 and up, and will have a suggested manufacturer's retail price of $70. The projected date for the game to hit store shelves is March 17th, and you can learn more by going to mayfairgames.com. Fantasy Flight Games announced the upcoming release of two exciting new expansions for Dust Tactics, the tactical miniatures board game of explosive battlefield combat. With The Boss, an Allied Rangers Command Squad or Commando Troop and Axis Sturmgrenadier Command Squad, you'll gain a new level of control over your Dust Tactics forces. Both The Boss and Commando Troop have the Command Squad ability, making them indispensable in overseeing your other forces. Their exceptional motivational skills even allow them to reactivate units that you've already used. What's more, both squads have the Artillery Strike ability, meaning they can serve as spotters for any friendly tank armed with artillery, as will be included in the new artillery rules in the Operation Cyclone campaign expansion. The Boss is a squad of Allied officers, and they're on the battlefield to ensure that every order is perfectly executed. Like other Rangers, the Allied Command is equipped with assault rifles and a machine gun, but their real strength lies in their ability to coordinate the attacks of other units. Known for its powerful leadership capability, this unit is a high-priority target that must be protected at all costs. But used wisely, they'll tip the balance in your favor. For the Axis forces, Commando Troop is a special unit of field officers whose skills are invaluable. They too are equipped with assault rifles and a machine gun, and like their Allied counterparts, their presence on the battlefield can change the entire course of battle. A wise general should take care to protect these experienced officers. FFG will soon announce the availability of premium painted figures as well. In other related Fantasy Flight news, the rules for the Battlestar Galactica expansion, Exodus, are now available for download at fantasyflightgames.com. With three new options to add to your game, Exodus is a great way to expand on the accusations and mistrust that run rampant in Battlestar Galactica. You can choose to add any combination of the three new options included in Exodus. Crave more white-knuckle space dogfighting? Incorporate the Cylon fleet option. The conflicted loyalties option introduces new loyalty cards that will test even the most trustworthy allegiances. Finally, relive the emotional turmoil of the hit TV series with the Ionian Nebula, which pits players against the various conflicting personalities aboard Galactica. In our final news piece, I'm sorry to say that, well, no doubt anyone listening already has heard the news, that the website Board Game News is no more. It's a real shame because Eric Martin and his crew of crack contributors did an excellent job bringing visitors some of the most in-depth coverage of what was new on the European front and what would be making its way to American shores. I'm pleased to say, for the most part, that BGN is going to be folded into Board Game Geek, although I'll keep my full opinion of that move to myself. But at least BGN won't be completely gone.
And now it's time for the Gaming Gang's game review. Try saying that 10 times fast.
I'm not going to try.
The latest in the 10 Days series of games is available from Out of the Box Publishing, and this time around it covers North and South America and all parts in between. It's titled 10 Days in the Americas, obviously enough. Designed by Alan Moore and Aaron Wiesblum, this chapter of the series continues with its simple yet strong mechanics, and Out of the Box continues to present first-class production quality and creates a visually striking game. 10 Days in the Americas is designed for up to 4 players, and the game has the players racing to be the first to put together a trip of connected points on the map by picking cards which represent countries and methods of travel. Each card represents one of the 10 days, either in a country or traveling via plane or ocean liner, and you have to create a continuous connected itinerary, starting and ending with any country card. This is a pretty simple game where you just create an itinerary that fits together. To help with this, you have the planes and the ships, but luck plays a major factor in the game because on your initial draw, you may look at what cards you have available and everything can seem pretty hopeless. The only chance you have to recover from a poor starting hand is keeping an eye out on discarded cards, and maybe you'll be lucky and draw some cards that you need as well. Overall, 10 Days in the Americas is a pretty fun game, and it does go relatively quickly. I have to be honest and admit that 10 Days in the Americas is the first game in the 10 Days series I've had the opportunity to play, but I'm sure many of you out there have played other games in the series, so you know what to expect with each of the games, and the artwork, as usual, is really nice. The game board is colorful and fairly clear as far as a map of the Americas and the connecting points for travel. One problem that I'll mention, and it's a pretty slight one at that, is that sometimes a lot of the small islands that you're playing with aren't very obvious. In fact, there's a magnified area of the board and able to help you out with that. These countries can be hard to see and find when you pull one of their cards. As I mentioned, luck plays a major factor in the game, and there is some frustration that could come from picking your initial 10 cards, which have to be placed in a starting order, and then trying to replace cards to eventually work your way to the 10 connected journey steps. That's the heart of the game. Either you're going to like that, or you won't. The luck element of the cards and the initial placement of your cards may not appeal to a lot of people who need some sort of a strategic flow in their games. In the 10-day series, you just need to go with the flow and work with the cards that you pick. You will get to see some of the cards, which is going to help, but not many because most of your cards you're going to draw blindly. And it certainly can be tricky to put the cards in a connected sequence, but for many people, that's the charm of the games. Overall, I'd have to say this is a fun game. A larger map might have been better, but then if you think about it, it probably wouldn't fit into the same format as the other games in the series, and it would probably bump the price up a bit. Also, there does seem to be a bit of an imbalance in the four-player game, in the fact that there's a lot more Caribbean Sea cards than other oceans, so it can make it really tough to put a run of cards together. It might work better as a two- or a three-player game. All in all, it's a fun family game. And for some of the kids out there, and let's be honest, some of we adults, learning about geography isn't always a bad thing, and this is a great way to do so and have fun at the same time. 1955, The War of Espionage, is a game on the horizon that's looking to be published by Living Worlds Games, I believe with an assist by Ape Games. Now, for myself, when I want to play something involving the Cold War, my go-to game is always Twilight Struggle. But here we have a shorter and simpler game that allows you to still play a world superpower during the Cold War. It's a two-player card game, and it's a nice contest. Now, the struggle of the Cold War is represented in the game by six countries, three from each faction. Each player has a spy counter, or otherwise known as a spiple, that they get to move from country to country. And some of the cards are things like revolution, military transport, pilfer accounts, and paid informant. I have to point out the copies that Elliot and I both received are not the actual production copies yet. So this is more of a in-depth sneak peek than a true review, because of course we haven't seen the finished product. But I can say that the artwork on the cards and the board are nicely done, and it's in a style that kind of reflects some of the old propaganda posters from the USSR, and that really helps set the tone of the game. The game will come with the game board. My understanding is it will be two-sided, and one side will be for a shorter game. You also receive a deck of 54 cards, the two spiples, and six control markers for each country. Each player gets a hand of five cards, and they choose their home country, which is going to be marked by a specifically colored control marker. Then you place your spy in your home country. You start off with an advantage in your home country represented by advancing the control marker one space. You see, the goal of the game is to secure control of three countries or gain control of your opponent's home country. On each turn, you'll be able to refill your hand to your five cards. There is a special card out there that does allow you to have a larger hand, and then you get to move your spy if you'd so desire. Most of the cards can be used in two ways. One, for their influence level, which allows you to move the control markers, or for the special action printed on the card. To play a card for influence, it has to be played in your home country, or where your spy is currently located, or in the country that's marked on the card itself. If you have multiple cards matching your spy's current location, you can combine them together in a combo. In addition, you can always add as many mercenary cards as you wish. Mercenary cards don't have any affiliated country. Then you get to move the control marker in your favor for that country. Your opponent can try to block your action if they have a spy present or if it's their home country by playing a number of cards equal to or greater than the influence level of the cards that you've just played. All of the non-mercenary cards also have these special actions, which allow you to send your opponent's spy back to their home country by deporting them, moving your spy during your turn, blockading a country to prevent its marker from being moved during that turn, and there's a lot of others. There are also other cards that allow you to counter one of these special actions. When a control marker reaches one end of the path, that country has been secured and can no longer be influenced, except with a revolution card. Once a player has three countries secured, or if the player loses control of their home country, the game ends. The full set of rules, which are still in a draft form, can be downloaded directly from the 1955 page on Kickstarter.com. The mechanics of the game are pretty simple, and it encourages a lot of balance in developing a strategy. For an example, the three countries for each faction have paths of different lengths. If you pick the US or USSR, which have the longest paths for a home country, that means your opponent needs to work that much harder to take it. But it also means that your extra influence isn't really worth that much to start off the game. A country with a shorter path could be trickier to defend, but would also be quicker for you to secure yourself. The location of your spy becomes very important, especially looking at your new hand of cards before you move that spy so you know where you can exert the most influence. Also, you have to keep in mind that you may need your spy to defend countries. Often, you need to move to wherever the opponent's spy is to be sure that you have a chance to block their actions. And even then, sometimes it's hard to decide. Do you play your cards to defend against an opponent's attack, or do you wait and save them for your own turn? Since nearly every card can be used for influence or a special action, you always have to decide which is going to be more effective, pushing a control marker in your direction or gaining other benefits. I really enjoyed the game, and it allows for a lot deeper strategy than I had expected when I first played through it. It does take a couple of playthroughs before you start looking into some of the special actions that can be used and can be combined into very effective combos. It will take a little bit of time to get a handle on the game because some of the rules are a little hard to remember, particularly when we're talking about when you can combine cards. For an example, for an attack, you can only combine cards that have the same country flag as your spy's current location, plus the mercenaries. For defense, you can combine any cards you want, but only in your home country or in your spy's location. In some cases, the color of cards, red or blue, will matter. If you use it on an opposite color country, then it's not worth as much. Probably this will be easier to remember with the planned reference cards to be included in the game, but I did find myself taking a peek at the rulebook every once in a while. Overall, 1955, The War of Espionage is a really promising game, and I do hope to see it goes to print. As of this recording, they're about $2,000 away from their goal with around 9 days to go. For a $30 pledge, you'll receive a copy of the game as well as two Spiteballs. For those of you who aren't familiar with Kickstarter, keep in mind if the goal isn't reached by the deadline, you'll get your pledge back, so you won't lose any money if the game does not go to print. GMT recently reprinted their entry-level war game designed by Jeff Horger, Maneuver, and it seems to myself that there's a higher level of component quality than the original 2008 release. They included cards, and each nationality receives their own 60-card deck, and there are 8 nationalities to choose from. The cards do seem a little small, but when you have such a great number of cards to include in the box, as well as the other components, I can understand the smaller size. The artwork on the counters is nice, and it's done by Roger B. McGowan, as usual with the GMT, and it's also obvious with the counters what country they belong to and the type of unit being represented. The artwork on the cards is similarly well done. The player reference cards, while being printed on some very light cardstock, provide everything you'll need at a glance while playing. Setup begins by determining who's going to be the first player. That player then chooses 4 map sections. Every map section is a 4x4 tile, further divided into 16 movement squares. Each tile also contains different terrain features printed on them as well, and then the first player sets up the 4 map tiles to arrange a larger square map. The second player chooses the 2 nationalities that will take the field of battle. There are 8 nationalities in all: France, Britain, Russia, Spain, Austria, the Ottoman Empire, Prussia, and the United States. The nationalities have their own strengths and weaknesses. Some countries may have more cavalry, others may be focused more on infantry. Others react differently after they've taken casualties, and there are enough differences that appear in the cards for each combatant so that they all play uniquely. The first player then gets to choose which nation he wishes to play, and then each player takes their nation's deck and counters. The second player gets to choose which side of the map to set up their forces. Each player then shuffles their deck of cards. The 60 cards in the deck are broken into 2 types: unit cards and headquarter cards. Each unit, and there are only 8 counters for each army, has 5 cards dedicated specifically to them, and you must use one of these cards for that appropriate unit to initiate combat. The headquarter cards include army leaders and also include special actions that army can perform. Each player draws 5 cards, and this will be the standard hand size throughout the game. The players then place their forces on the board with the knowledge of what cards they already have in hand for the first turn. Maneuver breaks down into phases. Each player performs all of his phases, and then the other player follows with theirs. The game is mainly card-driven, and the cards in hand determine what units may move or attack. The first phase is the discard phase, and you can discard as many cards from your hand as you wish. The second phase is the draw phase, where you'll draw as many cards as needed until you have those 5 in your hand. The third phase is movement. One unit on your side must move during this phase. There's no sitting back and turtling up and letting your opponent come to you. All movement is forward or back, left or right. Diagonal movement is not allowed. Infantry move 1 square and cavalry can move up to 2. Now, there are cards that allow additional units to move or an additional square of movement as well. The fourth phase is combat. Only one unit is activated in this manner during each turn, and you must have a unit card in order to engage in combat with that unit. There are four types of combat: ambush, assault, bombardment, and volley. Volley and bombardment are essentially the same. You roll the dice indicated on the volley value or bombardment value on the card, add your unit's strength, and compare it to the defender's strength and terrain. If the attacking roll is higher than the defending value, then you reduce that enemy unit. A reduced unit has its counter flipped, and the new values from the flip side are now to be used. If the enemy unit was already reduced, it's eliminated instead. The difference between a bombardment and a volley is that the former can be performed from two squares away, provided there's a line of sight, and the latter can only be used from an adjacent square. Not all unit cards have these attack options, and they have to be printed on the card to be used. Assaults are resolved by the attacker playing his unit card. The defender may play a unit card, and/or a leader card, and/or headquarters card to modify their defense total. The attacker can then play additional cards to modify his own totals. The unit cards for attacking specify the number of dice to use to modify the combat. Additional units can be brought in with the use of leaders. After everything is totaled up, the ratio is determined. If the attacker loses, he's reduced. If the defender loses by less than 2-1, they get to choose whether to retreat a space or to be reduced. A win of 2-1 gets the attacker the ability to choose whether the defending unit is reduced or retreats. Winning by 3-1, the unit is reduced and retreats, and 4-1 or greater, the unit is eliminated outright. Assaults can be avoided with withdrawal cards by the defender. This allows the defender to retreat voluntarily. After all retreats, the attacking unit must move into the vacated space unless their unit card played says that they don't have to. Cavalry that do this also get a pursue action. On their unit card that was played, there's a pursue range. A single die is rolled, and if it's within that range, the defender takes a hit and is reduced. Ambushes are done from special cards included in a deck. They're resolved like a sneak attack. The defender can play unit cards for the unit being attacked, or leaders, or other headquarter cards to modify their defense rating. Then the battle is resolved like an assault, except there's no assaulting unit. This is the only way to attack without a unit card. The final phase is restoration. This is where you can attempt to restore a reduced unit to full strength through the use of cards. Also, defensive redoubts can be played during this phase. Winning the game can happen in two ways. The first is an attrition victory, which is when a side takes out five of the opposing units. The second option is that night falls. This is represented by the fact that both players have gone through their deck one time. When this occurs, each side totals up the number of squares they control in enemy territory, and victory points are given. This is by no means a historical simulation of Napoleonic warfare, and it's more of an introductory game to share with non-wargaming friends. You can run through a game in about an hour or less, and there's plenty here to bring you back for more just because of the sheer fun involved. Sure, it may not be GMT's crowning achievement, but it is a solid game to break out when time is an issue. And I did mention it's loads of fun. The final game I'd like to take a look at is also from GMT, and it's not something I would in my wildest dreams consider to be light in the same vein as Maneuver. It's Labyrinth, The War on Terror, 2001 ? And right now it's in the running for my best game of 2010. Now, I've gone into a lot of detail about the game already in my review on the website, so if you'd like to see a breakdown in the gameplay, feel free to take a look at it there. But I'm still going to touch on the game nonetheless. I'm not sure if a game can be considered important, as in important in the great scheme of things, since we are talking about a game, of course. I obviously know board games are used as learning tools and to teach. If we're looking at a game as a way to learn something and not just simply as entertainment, Labyrinth: The War on Terror is a tremendous achievement. When talking about Islamic extremists, the comedian Bill Maher once said, "They hate us because we don't know why they hate us." Now, I can't say playing Labyrinth will provide us with any of the true motivation of the jihadists or their hatred of the Western world, but the game can most definitely open a lot of eyes to what lies behind the headlines while laying out the real aims for both combatants in this war on terror. The game itself is for two players. One side takes the US, the other side takes the jihadists. There are also solitaire rules involved, which I think are very important and will go a long way towards making this game as successful as it should be. Because let's be honest, a lot of people out there would not want to play the Islamic jihadists. It is a card-driven board game along the veins of Twilight Struggle, but there is a lot of difference between the two. Now, let me say the designer Volko Rümke and the gang at GMT had their hands full when the decision was made to go ahead with Labyrinth, the War on Terror. Here we have a game simulation of events that are not only fresh in our collective memories, but even many which have yet to come to pass. Not only would that normally be tricky to pull off successfully, but add into the mix that one of the antagonists is a side that many listening would not feel comfortable taking the reins of. And you can see that there was a lot of risk putting this game together, and I certainly do applaud all of those involved for getting Labyrinth to print. I can happily say for those who possess a mature worldview, Labyrinth is not only a fascinating game, but a tremendous experience that can lead to a lot of discussion between the players once they leave the table. That's not something that can easily be said about most games. Rümke walks a very fine tightrope where the overall goals of the US and the Islamic jihadists are clearly presented without resorting to over-the-top propaganda or bias. What is the goal of the extremists? What is their win scenario? How can the US accomplish their goals? How can they bring an end to the war on terror? Labyrinth answers many of these questions. As usual, the components are top-notch, and that does seem to be redundant lately with games that are coming from GMT. We can expect excellent components and production value. Once again, we have a nice big board on which plenty of info is right there at the player's fingertips. I say it's a big board because it lays out at 22 inches by 33 inches, so don't expect to be playing Labyrinth on your coffee table and still have room to maneuver. The counters are well done, as are the wooden blocks and cylinders used to track US troop deployments and jihadist cells. The cards which drive the action are also presented nicely. Setup is fairly easy, although many of the counters that will be utilized later should be sorted off to the side of the map, and that takes up a bit more space. In the box are the rulebook and a playbook as well. The playbook will be essential because there's a lot to get your head around in Labyrinth, and I'm going to point out that it seemed as if I had to dig around a bit more to find what I was looking for, something that normally doesn't happen to me with a GMT release, and the detailed playthrough in the playbook really helps quite a lot. Seemingly, as with just about any card-driven war game these days, especially those coming from GMT, there will immediately be comparisons to Twilight Struggle. I'll have to say that many of those comparisons will probably come from folks who haven't actually sat down with Labyrinth and sank their teeth into the meat of this title. It is important to keep in mind that the US and jihadists play very, very differently. So when you learn to play one side, you sort of have to relearn the game to play the other side. Both Labyrinth and Twilight Struggle do share some mechanical and graphical similarities, such as cards containing events to be played or used for operations points. The look of the game boards to some extent and the concept of influencing countries is a little bit similar, but pulled off much differently through the mechanics. At the end of the day, though, Labyrinth and Twilight Struggle are completely different beasts. As I mentioned before, Labyrinth is an excellent game, and it is well within my top 5 games of 2010. It may end up being the top spot. Labyrinth, The War on Terror, 2001 to ? Deserves a spot on any self-respecting gamer's shelf. Well, gang, that's just about it for this time around. Thanks for sticking with me through this solo edition of The Gaming Gang. But before I go, I do have a contest to share. As always, it's going to be an easy one. We're going to tackle our favorite games of 2010 on the January 2nd, 2011 edition. So if you'd like to give us a call at 480-779-7365, let us know what you thought was the best game of the past year. And you're entered into the contest. We'll be choosing the best answers to include on our first show of the new year, but we don't have to use your answer on the podcast for you to win. So give us a call and tell us what you think. We're offering up a brand spanking new copy of Victory Point Games' latest Astra Titanis delivered right to your door. And remember, you can't win if you don't play. Now, since you've probably forgotten what Elliot's voice sounds like, here he is to end the show.
You've been listening to the Gaming Gang Podcast with Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller. If you'd like to know more about the topics or games we discussed in this episode, please visit our website at www.thegaminggang.com. If you would like to have your opinion heard or have a gaming issue you'd like us to discuss on a future podcast, you can visit the Gaming Gang Guild on BoardGameGeek or call us at 480-779-7365 and leave a message. Our show notes are provided by James Englehart and can be found on our website. If you enjoyed listening to our podcast, please rate us on iTunes. Some of the games discussed on our show were provided to the Gaming Gang in the form of review copies. On behalf of everyone here at the Gaming Gang, thanks for listening.